Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast, episode 59. I'm Tiernan Diab and I'd like to say that as the new president-elect of France, Emmanuel Macron, vowed to fight divisions across France, that actually I stand by French mathematicians who say, hey, that'll make things really tough for us, please don't. Yes, France proved that not only are they better than the UK and US at pastries and shrugging, but also they tower over us in not being fooled by dog whistle politics, even though loads of them have dogs. Yes, Front National's Marine Le Pen did get 33.1% of the presidential election vote, which is a scary amount for someone whose policies seem to have been borrowed from the film Iron Sky. But considering Macron is a former banker who worked under the unpopular President Hollande and only created his political party 13 months ago, has many policies that are sensible rather than popular, and is only 39, he's not done too badly. It seems France like underdogs as well as, dogs. I honestly can't tell if I'm happier for the French that they've managed to avoid a Le Pen leadership, or if I'm happier for the UK because once again Nigel Farage, Katie Hopkins and the Daily Mail were all horribly wrong about something. The Leave EU campaign, you know, the one founded by the penguin of politics Aaron Banks when he read out loud from the Book of the Dead, well, they tweeted, the French rolled over in 1940, this time they've saved Germany from the fuel and the bullets. Because it seems in 2017, according to them, not electing a Nazi is the new electing a Nazi. To be honest, if they've spent this whole time reading history books backwards, it would explain an awful lot. In the UK local elections last week, it seemed that British people are also tired of right-wing bigots, as UKIP lost all but one council seat, and there is something very pleasing about them being told to go back where they came from. Sadly, that was the only good news for anyone other than the Conservatives, who swept up the formerly UKIP voters when they realised that Theresa May is actually just Paul Nuttall with hair and friends who she wouldn't even bother to try and pretend would ever attend a football match in Liverpool. The Conservatives also took votes from the Lib Dems and Labour, gaining a total of 558 council seats across England, Wales and Scotland. Yes, Scotland, including Conservatives gaining councillors in Glasgow in one of those events that makes you spend the next 3 days glancing up at the sky expecting a pig to shit in your eye from 20,000 feet. This landslide victory, so-called because it's a result of years and years of erosion, followed a speech from Theresa May in which she said the EU were to blame for the failure of Brexit so far, and that EU officials have timed hardening their negotiating stance to affect the general election. Yes, that's right. May has said that the EU are trying to sway the election results of an election she's only called because it's in her favour. She probably thinks it's the EU's fault that they're still around after the UK's referendum result last year, and it's selfish all 27 member countries haven't just ceased to be. How incredibly selfish of Pangaea to break up into different continents into the Oligocene period 20 million years ago, despite the shifting of tectonic plates being fully aware that in 2017 Theresa May would be trying to stay Prime Minister. How bloody dare they? Theresa May followed that up by going to Cornwall, where she insisted local journalists were locked in a room until she could give them a 3-minute interview. But no filming, because you know it seems that a strong and stable leadership is one that hopes the press will have to say nice things about you as they're now suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. Then she went on to eat chips, pulling the sort of faces that any normal person would only make if they're being forced to chew on Eamon Holmes' scrotal sack while imagining chewing on Eamon Holmes' scrotal sack. Yes, in 2015, then Labour leader and extra on The Simpsons, Ed Miliband, was destroyed by the press for being unable to eat a bacon sandwich without looking like he was gulping down lumps of his own Edstone. But here we are in 2017, and it's likely our Prime Minister is one who can't even eat chips without getting angry about it. Is it because she's worried that somehow Labour will catch up? Perhaps she prefers waffles. Maybe she just has a fear of dips. Or maybe it's just that she thinks human food tastes really bad and couldn't wait to hide away and drink a gallon of petroleum to take the taste away. Meanwhile, Labour dealt with their mass local election losses by saying it wasn't as bad as predicted. The sort of thing you'd only say when you climb out of a car crash and see half of your vehicle is on fire and all your passengers are dead. But hey, at least the funny bee on top of your aerial is still intact and you really like walking. Meanwhile, other Labour MPs, who are still certain being in opposition means they have to oppose themselves all the time, said it was an unmitigated disaster because there is nothing that helps your general election prospects like telling everyone just how shit you are. Earlier in the week, Shadow Home Secretary and owner of the most patronising voice since that supply teacher we all had in Year 8, Diane Abbott, had cocked up hugely on LBC Radio when she was interviewed by Nick Ferrari, a man whose name makes him sound like a car thief, but whose face and attitude make him appear like someone who actually steals women's underwear from washing lines. When asked about Labour's policing policy, Abbott said that they'd be hiring 10,000 officers for £300,000, which would mean that those officers were only getting £10 a year, and really that's not enough, you know, even for community support officers. Then she corrected herself and said actually it would be £80 million a year, which is still only an annual salary of £8,000, which isn't enough at all unless you plan on acting like the New Zealand police officers who bought several guinea pigs to teach kids about road safety. Yeah, seriously, look it up. They're guinea pigs, but they've got little police hats on. Oh, it's amazing. But Abbott's interview is horrific to listen to, and while it is on LBC, which is only ever really heard by cab drivers, you know, and people who walk past the open windows of cabs, Labour should have known that it would go viral and make sure that she was prepared, or, you know, use anyone else in the party at all. I mean, how can you run a party like that? What sort of incompetent move will they do next? Lock journalists in a room? It is something that Labour leadership need to be much, much better at, though, and have needed to be better at ever since Jeremy Corbyn became leader. On Sunday on the Andrew Marr Show, Marr asked Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, "Are you a Marxist?" And while you can complain that that's quite a vicious question to ask, as it's based on the fact that a number of people associate Marxism with, say, Lenin, rather than understanding it has many different factions and ideas to it, and that Marr hasn't ever asked Theresa May, "Are you an authoritarian?" or "Are you an android?" the fact is McDonnell still answered, "No, but there are definite benefits to reading Das Kapital." And to be fair, he's not wrong. As someone who's read all of about 5 pages of it and then got distracted and checked Twitter, Das Kapital has influenced many politicians, economists and others, including even George All the Jobs Osborne, who admitted Marx had it right on globalism earlier this year. But the better answer from John McDonnell should have been, "Which Marxism school of thought are you referring to, and exactly which political and economic theories, Andrew?" leaving Marx to explain specifics or look stupid. Or he should have just said, "Yes, there are many benefits to watching Duck Soup," which is a weak joke, true. But after the interview, the Conservatives put a meme on Twitter quoting John McDonnell saying Marx called for higher taxes, which is wrong because Marx believed in progressive taxations, i.e. higher taxes the more you earn. But he also felt like taxes were the life source of bureaucracy, comparing it in several German newspaper articles that he wrote as like serfs purchasing privileges from feudal lords. So I wondered why the Conservative meme was so wrong, thinking that Marx called for higher taxes. And then I remembered this bit in Duck Soup.
"Your Excellency, General Cooper says that the Sylvanian troops are about to land on Fredonia's soil. This means war."
"Something must be done. War would mean a prohibitive increase in our taxes."
"Hey, I got an uncle who lives in Texas."
"No, I'm talking about taxes, money, dollars."
"Dallas, that's where my uncle lives. Dallas, Texas." Ah.
Yes, that was a very tenuous way to justify a shit joke, but I feel oddly proud. Anyway, if all that wasn't enough for your week, on breakfast television this morning, Angry Thumb Ian Duncan-Smith rapped some of Eminem's Lose Yourself, referring the lyrics to Diane Abbott's radio fuck-up. It was so horrible that I won't play it for you here, but I feel like there are many other Eminem tracks that would be more suitable for IDS to rap, considering his time at the Department of Work and Pensions. For example, Guilty Conscience, Just Don't Give a Fuck, Bad Meets Evil, My Fault, Rock Bottom, Still Don't Give a Fuck, Kill You, Till I Collapse, Evil Deeds, Love the Way You Lie, Bad Guy, Assholes, or Brainless. Any of those would do. I look forward to him rap battling Michael Gove and then them somehow both losing. Oh, and Neon Varuka and President of America Donald Trump rushed through a vote to dismantle the Affordable Health Care Act, as he said it would make Obamacare essentially dead. If starting by killing something off isn't a terrifying sign for a healthcare bill, I don't know what is. Still, on the plus side, if this bill does kill off a ton of eligible voters in the US, they won't be able to vote Trump back in 2020. Hello, you. Thank you again for listening to this show. I hope you are well. I'm genuinely excited about you hearing the interview on this week's show. I think it is a real good un. I think that they're all good uns, but, you know, this one is a good duh. But more on that in a second. Firstly, a little bit of admin. Thank you very much to Rick and Sam for donating to the Partly Political Patreon. And you can do that too if you enjoy this show and want to donate. You can head to patreon.com/parpobro. And trust me, even a quid a month really, really does help me put this thing together. Or if you'd prefer to do it one-off rather than a monthly thing, then you can do that at ko-fi/parpolbrokofi.com. I missed the .com there. Just add a .com, ko-fi.com. Or don't. I've got some face-to-face interviews coming up, and I'm going to have to buy some new mic equipment for those, so all your donations so far are going towards that, and they are hugely helpful when I'm buying scratch cards to do while searching online for sound gear. Oh dear. No, seriously, it is hugely appreciated. Those scratch cards are great. For one a quid. Of course, if you don't want to or you can't donate to the podcast, of course, that is also trade cool. This show is free, like a democratic utopia ideal. But in which case, could you instead please review the show 5 stars on iTunes or Stitcher, like an authoritarian state where you have to pretend that everything is brilliant? Also, do subscribe to the show if you haven't already, as it means you get this the second I load it up online at some silly time of night. And please, please, please spread the word to anyone else that you think might like it. Or, in fact, anyone you think might not like it. Just spread the word. I mean, really, it's a lot like election campaigning. Also, I plugged all these shows last week, but tickets for the Stand Up for Refugees gig at the Birmingham Rep on May the 31st with Joe Lycett, Nish Kumar, Al Murray, Mrs. Barbara Nice, Alice and June Smith and me are selling very fast. You can grab them on the Birmingham Rep website, and all proceeds go to the Help Refugees charity. And there is a show in Bristol on June the 12th at the Tobacco Factory with Gary Delaney, Josie Long, Angela Barnes and more. June the 20th at Hartford Theatre with Adam Hills, Eleanor Tiernan and me again. And June the 21st at the Brighton Dome with, and we can announce it this week, Dara O'Brien, how exciting, Shappy Corsandi, Mark Steele, loads more, and me to ruin it all again. So grab tickets for those things on the website for those venues. Also, tickets are selling very nicely for the Fuck the Election gig on June the 8th at the Phoenix in Oxford Circus. This is a gig that I've put together basically to, it's going to be a stressful day, it's going to be stressful weeks leading up to it if you care at all about politics, and I thought on that evening for a couple of hours we can just get really drunk and watch some good comedy. I'm going to be hosting, I've added Mitch Benn to the lineup that already includes the brilliant Marcus Brigstock, Josie Long, Johnny and the Baptist, Bishop K. Ali, Bilal Zafar, Chris Coltrane, Joe Wells, and hopefully more to be announced soon. And I'll be honest, I'm unlikely to do a proper podcast that week, as really, what is the point when the results are going to be out like 3 days later, unless I maybe do global politics or something, which I might do. Let me know what you think. And so if you come along to the gig that night, you will hear the stuff that I probably would have podcasted, and we can all drink lots until we feel suitably dead inside to not care about the inevitable hellscape that follows. Tickets for that are on the Phoenix Cavendish Square's website, and I keep tweeting it and Facebooking it loads too. You know how the internet works, right? I'm not your dad. Similarly, the kids show I'm doing with Tat and Spiller from Simple Politics is called What's This General Election Thing All About? And that is on June the 4th at 1 p.m. and you can grab tickets for that at underbellyfestival.com. So please bring your small people along. Right, admin done. On this week's show, I talk to Meevan and Joseph at Full Fact. Exciting, you know, the site that I blab on about pretty much every single show. And they tell me how that they get actual facts, how they stay completely non-partisan, independent, and all about the issues with providing fact-check knowledge through a snap election. Also, there's stuff on local elections, general elections, French elections, projections, objections, and a dorsiflexion. Well, okay, the last one is simply because I've got a slight foot cramp. Hang on a minute. Ah, fixed. Much better. Right, but before all of that, there is, of course, this. Félicitations, France. You saw that Le Pen was backed by all those alt-right Pepe the Frog twats and subsequently ate their legs off. Yes, while Macron, a centrist former banker, wasn't the ideal choice for a country disillusioned with the establishment, it seems he was a firmly preferable candidate for president to French tastes than the racist narrative of Marine Le Pen, a woman who constantly looks like if you asked her to house sit, you'd return home to find that she had bought you some milk, but also gnawed through your sofa. It's easy to focus on the fact that she got 10.6 million votes, or 33.6% of the vote, but it's also worth noting that it was the lowest turnout for an election in France in 48 years. Yeah, that was still 74.6% turnout, which is like looking at the UK's exam papers with a big D on them, and France complaining that it only got an A star without merit. At 12.1 million people not voting, more people didn't bother than did and voted Le Pen, and 4 million ballots were spoiled or blank as a protest. And probably, as with Trump and Brexit, some of those who voted for Le Pen knew exactly what she stood for, and others less so, with an anger and a want for change. Macron wasn't the most alternative candidate for president in some ways. He's very pro-EU and he wanted a new relationship with Berlin, which is quite unpopular right now. He's a former banker, while France is in a state of being anti-finance and establishment. He's embraced integration, which is again a source of discord in France. He's promised tough reforms and he's young and middle class. But then in other ways, he's quite alternative in that up until just over a year ago, he didn't even have a political party until he created one in En Marche. On top of all those things making him sound like he could be a character in a Cameron Crowe film, on Friday, as French news had to stop broadcasting political content, tons of Macron's campaign data was hacked and lots of documents including emails and financial data was released online by WikiLeaks, and the documents were all mixed up with fake files. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure this all has nothing at all to do with Marine Le Pen's many links with Russia. If I had a camera, I'd look knowingly at it right now. Yeah, right now. With a smile, I'm doing it. You can't see, but it's pretty perfect. Macron now has to assemble a government, which may be trickier than assembling Avengers, considering the few numbers in his own party. And then there's parliamentary elections in June, which is either going to result in a coalition, or somehow 280 people are going to have to apply for a job as En Marche MPs and somehow get that job between now and then so he can have a majority, or loads of other MPs leave their parties to join his. And I'm pretty sure that's going to happen, especially considering En Marche sounds like it's probably how the elephant song must go in the French version of the Jungle Book. I'd be in with that. So Macron is probably going to be the president of a coalition government then, and then he's going to have to try and uphold his promise of political renewal, which might be harder in a coalition depending on who's in it, and he can't just draft in loads of established politicians, otherwise that's not really political renewal either. And as well as his own government, it's going to be very interesting to see what he does to do with the UK's Brexit negotiations. In a statement on Brexit, Macron said that Mr. Farage and Mr. Johnson are responsible for this crime. Which, while it gets referendums and crimes confused, which is not good for the French legal system, it does mean that Macron won't be giving Theresa May an easy ride to Euro Tradeland. Which is a terrible theme park, by the way. I mean, the Greek slide is really too much for most people. And will he bring France what it needs overall? Well, Macron has to somehow repair a pretty divided country. Sound familiar? And only time will tell. We'll check back in with France on the podcast after their parliamentary elections. But until then, I'm going to relish telling far-right trolls on Twitter that they lost, so they should really get over it. According to a long read in The Guardian, and yeah, that is the only way to say that sentence, journalists and researchers at the paper have found yet more links and evidence to suggest that data analytics firm Cambridge Analytica had quite a role to play in the Brexit referendum campaign and possibly result. If you remember back in episode 47, I interviewed Leslie Hallam about the way in which psychometrics and targeted advertising can influence opinion. And overall, to summarise, he said, yeah, it can, and it's really scary. And by analysing the information on your Facebook page, adverts could potentially be directed at you that appeal specifically to your personality, driving you to vote in a certain way. I won't go fully into the article on The Guardian as it's very worth a read and it's quite dense in terms of content, but the official Leave campaign group, Vote Leave, spent £3.9 million, half of its campaign budget, on a web analytics company called Aggregate IQ during the Brexit campaign. So did three other Leave campaigns, which is illegal to do under UK election law unless coordinated campaign expenditure is declared, which it wasn't. And it appears at least one of those other campaigns was contacted directly by Aggregate IQ, making it definitely look a lot more like a coordinated affair. The Guardian has found links between this company, Aggregate IQ, and Cambridge Analytica, the latter owned by Robert Mercer, who is a computer scientist and millionaire and good mates with waste of skin Nigel Farage, and funded Steve Bannon, you know, the alt-right advisor to Donald Trump, who looks a lot like something you forgot was in your fridge until you find it 6 months later in a terrifying condition. And they funded Steve Bannon to create Breitbart. So Cambridge Analytica were also hired first for Ted Cruz and then for Trump's campaign, and while it is hard to pin down if psychometrics data analysis can definitely sway minds, there's also enough evidence to suggest it can definitely help. Anyway, to cut a very long story short after explaining it quite badly, it looks like the only way to uncover how much of the Brexit referendum was the fault of Cambridge Analytica would be via a public inquiry. And of course, that would require the government to suggest that perhaps the vote wasn't democratic and they shouldn't be ploughing ahead with the general election in order to gain more power. All I'm saying is, until this can be uncovered further, maybe just delete some Facebook details, eh? I mean, if nothing else, it'll give your friends something to be concerned about, and you can laugh as they wonder why both your relationship status and favourite films are now blank. Do read the full article. It's called The Great British Brexit Robbery by Carol Cadwallader. And if you have more time on your hands, find previous podcast guest James Patrick, J_AMESP. He's written a 5-part series of articles for Byline.com on his investigations into Cambridge Analytica, which go even more in-depth and are terrifying. So read that and then throw your computer in a river and give Minority Report a low rating on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, just to be safe. Here's a fact for you. Facts are super important. Fact! According to Wikipedia, a fact is something that is postulated to have occurred or be correct using verifiability. Wikipedia does also say that a fact is a Belgian anime convention and the self-titled album of a Japanese hardcore band called Fact, but you know, we'll stick with the first definition for now. My favourite fact, out of interest, I know you're interested, is that wombats poo in cube shapes. Yeah, they do. You can have that, and then you can spend inordinate amounts of time, like I do, imagining how if they all pooed in a certain way, they could build giant wombat poo structures all over Australia. See how great facts are? They are great. Fact. Facts have a hugely important role in politics, of course, even more so in the last few years, when it appears that all facts took a holiday during the entirety of 2016, allowing big statements to be written on buses with little to no factual basis whatsoever, or US presidential candidates to just make things up in speeches as they went along. And look how terrible things have got because of all that. Really terrible. Fact. Since then, alternative facts and fake news are terms that have been in the media constantly, with an influx of false statements circulating the internet, both from fake news sites and also from people like Donald Trump's senior advisor Kellyanne Conway, who at one point made up an entire massacre that didn't actually happen, even though UKIP leader Paul Nuttall is certain his friends were victims of it. Sadly, in this day and age, it can be a lot easier to read, click and share statements that may not be true, rather than, you know, spend time researching for the actual facts behind things. But luckily, while the internet has spewed out tons of not-truths in amongst, you know, its cat pictures and GIFs of parrots dancing to Elvis, it has also meant that it's much easier to get access to proper information as well. Which is where Full Fact comes in. Full Fact is the UK's independent fact-checking charity who are completely impartial, and whose aim is to help halt the spread of misinformation. With a general election coming up, I thought it'd be useful to talk to them about what they do, how they do it, what you can do to ensure you find the facts, and why it might be useful to use them in the next few weeks. And, well, all of the time. In just the past few days, I've used them not only for this podcast, but also to check Labour's comments that crime is up under the Conservatives, which the answer to that is actually, in general crime, numbers have fallen, but some crime has risen, and changes in recording practices mean that it's hard to say, and the Conservatives' comments that the government has protected school funding, which is actually correct right now, but it's about to fall, especially once inflation is taken into account. See? Nothing is easy. Ever. But it is very nice to have the facts. Fact. I spoke to Joseph O'Leary, who is a senior researcher for Full Fact, and Meevan Babaker, who is the Digital Products and Supporter Communications Manager, which is an excellently long job title. Well done, Meevan. And they both told me all about facts. As in, you know, things that are correct, not Belgian anime or Japanese bands. But I bet they could if they wanted to, because they've got facts. Here's Meevan and Joe. So, hi, Meevan and Joe. Thank you very much for talking to me. First question, mainly for the listeners, although they should know what Full Fact is now because I bore them about it most weeks on my podcast. But can you tell me a little bit about what Full Fact is and why it was set up? And also, really, if you feel like the importance and need of Full Fact has kind of grown in the last 2 to 3 years.
So going back to the start, Full Fact started publishing in 2010. And the reason at the time was that politics was bewildering. There were parties on all sides who were making claims, and the same with the media. And people just didn't know who to trust because, you know, people weren't being very transparent with their sources. People were just talking past each other. And the idea behind Full Fact was, wouldn't it be great if there was a place that went and checked those claims and provided people with the sources, links to those sources, so that they can make their own minds up. And so it's a way of kind of seeing through the noise and finding something that, you know, gives you the ability to place informed trust. And that's what it was all about. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I was quite surprised because I've been using your site quite a lot in the last few years. I didn't realise you set up in 2010. Mm. I think for a lot of people, we assume that kind of fake news and things has only been is a very recent phenomenon.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for quite some time. And when we started, we had to really convince people that bad information leads to bad decisions. And we had this whole spiel about different ways that that has caused like mass bad effects in public life. But now all you need to do is say post-truth and fake news and everybody kind of understands. So it's been a real shift in the past year, really, is it? That we've seen people really understand why fact-checking is important and why transparency and scrutiny is even more important than ever.
How do you do it? How are you fact-checking these things? So, you know, you cover quite a lot of information on your site. How are you getting it? How are you getting it all when the everyday person is finding it quite hard to find some of this stuff?
Well, a lot of it comes down to familiarity with where all the facts come from. I mean, actually, you'd be surprised that, you know, if you looked at our site and looked at where we get our facts from, a huge proportion come from, say, the Office for National Statistics that produces loads of the information that we have in this country, and government departments produce their own figures as well. So part of it is just a familiarity, knowing where to look. But it's also understanding that even though these are the sources of our figures, they're often, you know, quite confusing. Sometimes they can be quite misleading in how they present the numbers as well. So if you're a member of the public and you go to one of these sites, you're not necessarily much better off because you're trying to wade through loads of numbers that you don't necessarily know what they mean. You don't have any context. So part of fact-checking is about having the expertise as well, having a kind of flair in communication to be able to take what are often quite dry numbers that don't mean anything to anyone and kind of make them fun and engaging. And that's a big part of what fact-checking is about. And that's our whole tone at Full Fact. It's like, you know, facts can be accessible to anyone. And, you know, here they are in a way that's accessible to you if you don't, you know, live and breathe politics every day. That's the idea.
It's the research that you might do if you had many, many years of time available to you. And it's our job to basically do that for you, lay out with all the nuance and the complexity and to give it to you so you can make up your own mind in the simplest possible way. But a lot of it also comes down to calling up the people who made the claim and asking them, where did you get your information from? What sources were you using when you said this? Why did you interpret it in this way? And trying to sort of unravel the many different ways that one spreadsheet can be interpreted.
Yeah, it's because I've looked at certain government reports and National Office of Statistics and things before, and there is just so much to wade through to find the one little bit you're interested in. And do you think that sort of part of internet culture and clickbait and social media, do you think it's made it harder for people to get to the correct information? I think, you know, people are less patient now, I think, to find it, but also, you know, supposed facts are thrown out right there, and it, you know, people find that a lot easier to do than look in a report. So has online culture made us less good at fact checking, do you think?
It's just not an easy job, that's the problem. I'm in the comms team and I hang around the fact checkers an awful. I've been around for like 3 years now, and I would still say trying to find one fact on one thing is incredibly difficult, even when you know the spreadsheet that you're looking for, you know the statistician, you know that all the releases about it. It's still really hard to interpret it. So I think I wouldn't really blame internet culture so much, but there is an awful lot to check these days. And there is an awful lot of information parading as the best and most reliable information. So it's about placing your trust in things and having the time to kind of unravel the complexity that exists, which is hard.
Yeah, definitely. And do you think people have got, I mean, because your site's obviously been around since 2010, have you noticed a surge in use? Do you think people have got more savvy since the fake news post-truth thing came, sort of got more into mainstream language?
I like to think that people have got more curious. I'm not sure about savvy. I mean, maybe might have a view on that. But I think, as Meevan was mentioning, because there's almost a meme going about everyone's using these terms fake news and post-truth. I think people are a lot more aware of it. Now, whether that means they actually change their behavior and, you know, wait a few more seconds before clicking share when they see that actual claim, I wouldn't know. But it's, I mean, our traffic has certainly increased a huge amount. And we've been getting requests from all kinds of, you know, TV and radio asking, you know, whoa, what's this thing called fact-checking? You know, what do you do and things? so there's definitely curiosity in the brand of fact-checking and how fact-checking. I mean, we've actually been expanding our work to schools lately as well, because we've been getting, we've been getting interest basically from teachers who are saying to us, you know, we've seen your work recently. This is the kind of thing I want to teach my class. Do you have any resources to help us? Because critical thinking is, you know, broadly speaking, critical thinking is important, and people see that importance at a young age as well. So that's where we're trying to, I think, hopefully trying to hit in the future.
I think it's really hard if you're going, the choices you have as a consumer of information is based in the face of all of this fake news stuff, is either to blindly trust everything that you hear, to be blindly cynical of everything, or to be completely apathetic and be like, there's no way I can make sense of this. That's what fact-checking is meant to do, is meant to give you a way out of those choices. It's meant to say, well, here's the best available information. You don't need to blindly trust or be blindly cynical. We can tell you what the lay of the land is. Here's best available stuff that we can give you. Here's something to help you place your trust selectively. And what my favorite thing about audience numbers is, 2 days before an election or a vote, our numbers like quadruple. And that's kind of when everybody wakes up and everybody's like looking for the facts on the one issue that they care about most, that's going to help them determine how they're going to vote. I think it's just people aren't politically active all the time. But when it matters, a lot of people, and like a couple of days before a vote, a lot of people wake up and realize that they have a responsibility to vote and they want to make an informed vote. And I think there's a big feeling of, I don't know enough to be able to vote, or I don't know enough to be able to have an informed vote. And I think I'm really proud of the service we offer because it helps people make that choice.
Definitely. It's something, I mean, it is very hard to keep up with politics all the time. I do it, you know, for the podcast and generally for my comedy material. And every week I'm watching the news and I still find if I miss a day, I haven't got a clue what's been going on. You know, it's tricky. Yeah. Absolutely, it's really tricky. And I think is also, because I know that I follow, obviously, you on Twitter when you fact check Question Time or Prime Minister's Questions. But do you think, like, that is enough? Do you think these shows should just have fact-checking on them anyway? Because I find a lot of that influences. I hear people sort of say sound bites from those programs back at me without ever having looked up what those sound bites are to do with. Mm. You know, is it enough to just have the fact-checking available? Does it need to be kind of a bit more prevalent in live debates and things?
I think it absolutely needs to be more prevalent. And not only does it need to be more prevalent, it needs to be more instantaneous. So the stuff that we've been secretly working on is automated fact-checking. Because we're sitting on all these many claims that we've fact-checked from 2010, we see them being repeated an awful lot. The nature of public debate in the country is that politicians and campaigners repeat themselves. That's how you get a message out into the world. So what we can do is build tools that automatically spot every single time a claim that we've fact-checked has come up in a new place.
Wow.
And that might be Question Time, that might be Prime Minister's Questions, it might be a TV debate during an election. And to be able to, within a second of them saying the claim, bring up the verdict in real time, overlaid onto the screen, would be pretty cool. So we're trying to make as much of that possible for the election, but obviously it's a snap election. But regardless of the election, we have plans to start releasing these tools, which we're using internally at the end of the year. So there's a lot of exciting stuff, hopefully, that'll be coming out very soon.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because I remember there was very briefly, might have been the New York Times or somewhere, did a Trump fact checker on Twitter. I think it was like a Google Chrome plugin, and every one of his tweets would have the correct fact underneath it, or was meant to. And I don't think it's still available, sadly. But it was, it was used quite a lot, I think.
Yeah.
Very useful indeed. And so this, so automated fact checking would be an amazing idea. Do you think that would also possibly dissuade people from putting out statements that aren't correct? I mean, it's very hard to say, I guess.
It's always a race, really, because like we could actually show you examples of where, say, someone has put out a tweet and that tweet was incorrect, and they end up putting up a correction maybe a few hours, a few days later, and the correction gets a fraction of the retweets that the original tweet got. So you kind of think, oh, great, something went wrong. Even though we got them to correct it, it didn't really undo the damage done. So I think speed is a really important component, and Meven's absolutely right. It's being instantaneous is one of the most important things. Also, because I mean, we at Full Fact, there's something we call the they know we check effect, which is basically, I mean, it sounds really sinister, but it's really not. It's the mere fact that we do fact checking and that we publicize it widely and we have a wide audience creates an extra cost on people who want to make a claim that's unsubstantiated, because they know that someone out there is going to check them and potentially cause embarrassment about that. And the sooner that we can get out that kind of response and rebuttal, the sooner that we can maybe secure a correction. And, you know, as you know, the news can travel so fast. You know, one day, you know, we'll be talking about NHS waiting times, but a few hours later, we might move on to the royal family. And if you don't get something in that window that's a rebuttal of something that's been said, then you might as well give up, because everyone's moved on and you haven't undone the damage that's been done.
One of my favourite corrections was during the last election, the 2015 election. Do you remember that? So long ago. and it was Newsnight. They made a claim at the beginning of the programme. We tweeted them and emailed the editor, and at the end of the show, they corrected themselves. That was one of the fastest turnarounds of corrections we've ever had. Mm. So hat tip to Newsnight.
That's fantastic. And do you, well, in fact, a couple of questions based on that, but do you find, has the lead up to this election been, have you had a lot of work on your hands, or have you found that it's been a bit easier than, say, 2 years ago? You know, with this kind of they know we check.
it's been pretty hectic.
Yeah.
The day that the election was announced was my first day off in a while.
Oh no.
Back in the office that evening. We did have a snap election plan, and we are now putting it into place. We have partners who we work with, and it's the main bulk of our work right now has been getting those partners into a place where they really want to get stuck in and be a bit bolder this election and say more stuff.
It's important to say, actually, that we couldn't do what we do without our expert partners. I mean, fact checking isn't just you know, a bunch of young, bright, optimistic things in a room looking for all the information. We need that established expertise as well, and we need to be a network for that. And so, for instance, whenever we do immigration stuff, an organisation called the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford, they're experts, independent experts in the field, and we often kind of use their work, they use our work. So we work together, basically. Again, we provide the kind of top-level mass audience appeal, and they have they do the more in-depth analyses that we don't have the resources to do. And we have that network, and we couldn't do what we do without it. So it's a big part of our election work.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll be back with Joe and Meven in a minute, but first...
Elections over here, elections over there. There seems to be elections every bloody where. Elections every night, elections every day. And who to bloody thank for this is Mrs. Bloody May. Whee!
The local elections last week definitely proved a lot of things. One is that the UK has more places than I think. Two is that counting takes bloody ages. And three is that while the counting takes ages, the advent of 24-hour news means that they really do have to say a lot of bollocks to fill time while those people count. Oh, and number four, in the case of Northumberland, is that strawman opposition can actually work when it's literal strawman opposition, as the Conservatives were denied majority control of the council when a Lib Dem candidate drew the biggest straw. Yeah, really. I mean, next time someone asks if the UK democratic system is outdated, tell them that the entire structure of the governing body of Northumberland was decided by who got the largest piece of a dead stork. In terms of council elections, we also know UKIP were pretty much wiped out, losing 114 seats. Labour suffered huge losses of 320 seats, with a loss of overall control of 10 councils, and the Lib Dems lost 37 seats, which coincidentally is the amount of seats I lost during a week-long game of Extreme Musical Chairs. It was pretty harsh. And the winners were the Conservatives in this local election, with a gain of 558 seats, which is enough for them to set up a small theatre that they'd probably then cut the funding for and close immediately and turn into luxury unaffordable flats. The SNP gained 31 seats in Scotland, obviously, and Plaid Cymru in Wales gained 26, while the Green Party gained 6 over the UK, winning a total of 40. The Greens have actually just made a formal complaint to the BBC, as after making gains and holding 34 seats, they received little to no coverage, while UKIP only won one seat and lost everything else, but seemed to be on all the news channels constantly. The Greens do have a point, I think, and there is a constant joke that UKIP will never lose their seat on Question Time. But let's be fair, I did really, really enjoy watching various members of UKIP have to do interviews as they watch their pointless one-argument bigot gathering disappear from the map. There is little more enjoyable than a nationalist party finding out that no one in the nation wants them whatsoever. But while it's easy to think that UKIP's loss is the Conservatives' gain in a way that, you know, it's a zero-sum game for anyone centre or centre-left, and not just because UKIP now have zero anything and aren't part of any game, the reality is that while the Conservatives assimilated UKIP into their great big Tory bunch, also, they gathered Lib Dem Leave voters and Labour Leave voters as well. If you look, for example, at Birmingham in these local elections compared to the 2016 local elections, Labour lost 3.7% of the vote this time round. Lib Dems lost 5.9% of the vote and UKIP lost 5% of the vote, while the Conservatives gained 13.5% of the vote share. And we can sort of guess that put together that maybe that's due to May's Brexit stance and she's dragging over Leave voters who feel like UKIP have done the only one thing that they could ever bang on about. Maybe it's people who are sick of Lib Dems being so solidly Remain and have either lost faith in Labour or aren't too keen on their Brexit stance. And yeah, I'm also really worried about the missing 1.1% too, that didn't go to the Conservatives. I mean, what happened to them? Are they okay? Why does no one seem to care? Oh, and in the mayoral elections, Labour gained only Liverpool and Manchester, which Andy Burnham smashed with 63% of the vote, as though he has something on everyone in Manchester. What does he know? I mean, you know, I like Burnham, but he's not very exciting, is he? I sort of think of him as like a Nintendo Mii character you'd create if you wanted them to resemble no one in particular. But Labour did very well in the cities and then lost out in the marginals, such as West Midlands mayoral seat, which went to the Conservative candidate. West Midlands is Dudley North, which is a marginal Labour seat, and Dudley South, which is a marginal Conservative seat. And Labour lost the Tees Valley mayoral election to the Conservatives, which comprises of Stockton South, a Tory marginal, and Stockton North, a usually safe Labour seat. And while that doesn't look good for the Stockton North Labour seat in general, Labour lost by 0.4% of the vote, and you do wonder how much it is to do with Tees Valley only becoming a combined authority last year, and that its name sounds less like a governing area and more like a shit cafe. But the fact is, looking at the general election, we know that Labour might be alright in the cities, but in the marginals, it might be less than marginal. Labour did gain Blur drummer Dave Rowntree as a councillor in Norfolk County Council, though, which is pretty cool. Though I am worried that this might incentivise Labour to use Blur's music as backing tracks, and I really don't think Death of a Party would be a wise choice. Meanwhile, in Scotland, the Scottish Conservatives more than doubled the amount of councillors they have from 87 to 191, and took seats from mostly Labour, but also all the other parties as well. Possibly a reaction to Sturgeon's increased call for a second independence referendum, or maybe the entire country is just trying really hard to make the pandas in Edinburgh Zoo feel under pressure to have more cubs. As I said last week, there are a number of factors that mean we can't guess the general election results from these ones. Turnout was very, very low in some areas, for example. For the West of England mayor election, it was only 29.72%, which is really, really poor. People do often use local election votes differently, knowing that they relate to the council. Certain areas didn't have a local vote at all, and registration for the local election was already closed by the time Theresa May announced the snap election, which did gain a lot of registered voters after that date. But there is no denying that the Conservatives have done really well and that UKIP are dead and their voters have all been absorbed into the Conservative husk, even the ones that are originally Labour. The Lib Dems seem to have lost their Leave voting supporters and are only doing well in areas that they can never hope to win an MP seat, so it's completely pointless. SNP could be challenged hard in Scotland by the Tories, and Wales is a big old mess where it could really be anyone's. And Greens might do pretty well, but no one's going to put them on TV when you could have 5 hours of Paul Nuttall trying not to cry instead. As for the general elections, we now know that Labour are pledging no tax rise for anyone earning less than 80 grand a year, which is 95% of UK earners, but a tax rise for those who are earning over 80 grand a year in order to subsidise that. This has, of course, been criticised by a number of people who earn 80 grand or more, saying that it isn't very much money at all. The Tories said Labour wants a tax aspiration because, you know, there is nothing more aspiring than already having a lot of money, right? I mean, you remember those classic tales of achievement? Person with money, tries their best, gets more money? Ugh, great stuff. Meanwhile, the Conservatives also seem to think that £7.20 is an adequate minimum wage, even though I think it's aspiring if you work for Deliveroo and want to save enough money to do anything other than work for Deliveroo. The top 5% of earners in the UK pay almost half the tax, so Labour's plans would increase that. The Institute of Financial Studies says there is a risk the very wealthy might find new ways to avoid tax, so I guess it would just be the same as it is now then. Or they might move away. I mean, if they weren't contributing anyway, then it just means we're getting rid of useless rich people, which also brings down the overall net migration figure. I'm totally in. Labour have also pledged to recruit 10,000 new police officers, although we aren't sure if that's for £10 a year each or not. Who knows? Diane, any clues? They have pledged to give NHS workers a pay rise of more than 1%, bring back training bursaries for nurses, and bring back free parking at hospitals for staff and visitors, which is really good because there is nothing worse than getting your ambulance clamped for leaving it out the front of A&E for 2 minutes too long, eh? Then Labour also said they're going to restore student grants, bring back educational maintenance and carers allowance, and cover all of this with reversals of the cuts to corporation tax, capital gains tax and inheritance taxes, but we're going to have to wait for the manifesto to see if it'll all actually add up. Meanwhile, in between Theresa May blaming the EU for Brexit and telling people that she's not doing TV debates because she's having debates up and down the country, which she isn't because she won't meet with any public and locks journalists in a room, the Conservatives haven't really revealed much of their manifesto yet. But one thing Theresa May has said is that the Conservatives will pledge an extra 10,000 staff to work in the NHS mental health services, but they haven't said how they'll fund it. And with NHS funding set to fall again next year, this seems a bit of a premature pledge. Theresa May said that spending records on mental health services are at record levels, but there is actually no way to fact check that. So says the website of this week's guests, Full Fact. The government haven't actually published stats on changing in mental health funding since 2013, so we haven't got a clue. What we do know is that in the 2016 to 2017 financial year, 57% of clinical commissioning groups said that they plan to reduce their spending on mental health care. To be fair, if Theresa May really had any inclination to help people suffering from depression, she would have resigned months ago. In terms of their election campaign, the Conservatives have also said that there are no plans to raise taxes after the election, but they won't back a 2015 pledge that ruled out income tax or national insurance rises. Hey, I'm sure we can trust Theresa May's word on this though, right guys? I mean, remember when she promised not to have an election before 2020, right? It is very hard to criticise Labour's policies when we don't know the figures behind them all yet, and they've not been in power since 2010, and when they were, it was a very different Labour Party entirely. But the Conservatives have now been in power for 7 years. And what we do know for a fact is that food bank usage is at an all-time high. There is an 8% fall in education funding. Child poverty is set to double by 2020. Homelessness has risen 16% in the last year. Air quality is shit. Inflation is higher than wages. And Theresa May can't eat chips properly. David Davis has said that he's certain the UK won't pay £100 billion to the EU, which, judging by his record, could mean that we pay £999,999,999 billion instead. And we now have a 45% higher chance of a no deal at all, according to Lord Kerr, who drafted EU legislation. But despite all the Brexit shambles and the terrible state of things under this government, Jeremy Corbyn is still very, very unpopular. Labour is currently at 28.4% in the polls today, while the Conservatives have risen again to 46.5%. So, you know, maybe lots of other people hate eating chips as well. I mean, I suppose they do make me feel bloated sometimes. Maybe May has a point. With Corbyn and May refusing to take part in TV debates and May locking journalists in a room, it seems like neither will really get taken to task over any of their policies. And for May especially, she's just going to ride on knowing that the country's going to back her carrying out Brexit. As she says, to give her a stronger hand, as though if you all vote Conservative, she'll become the Iron Fist and then we'll have to sit through 13 hours of whitewashed boring narrative while everyone ever suffers. Our only hope right now is that if the TV debates do empty chair both Corbyn and May, Britain might end up electing an empty chair as Prime Minister, which would be a total win. It'd definitely be supportive and stable and have backing. Well, you know, its own, even if no one else's. Right, before I wrap up election chat for today, a very quick...
Do you have opinions? No, I think they taste bad. I think that you mean onions. Yes, they're disgusting. Hey, that's an opinion. Hooray for onions. Hooray for onions.
I remember being given a tip years ago at the Edinburgh Festival by a PR person. That's not proportional representation, that's press relations. I think they're related to people in the press. Anyway, I remember being given a tip by them, and they said that the key to good PR is to say that things are going really well, even if they aren't. You know, even if your show is selling badly, tell everyone numbers are great and it's going well. That way, people think it is, and they are more likely to come. If you say, nah, it is empty and awful and everything's going shit, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as it makes everyone that might come to your show think, well, fuck it if I'm going to sit through that then, if everything is awful and shit and no one else is going. With the Labour Party at the moment, either everyone does seem to realise this PR tip and is on self-destruct and honestly doesn't care if there's 5 more years of Conservative rule, if it means that they might possibly get back to the Labour Party that lost in 2015 instead, or they don't realise this PR tip. Personally, and you know this show is completely partisan because, well, me and my thoughts. And I did read that apparently it's bad podcast etiquette to give you my own opinions on my own podcast, but this entire show is bad podcast etiquette, so it's fine. I mean, have you heard the jingles? Personally, I feel like the Conservatives getting a massive majority is fucking terrifying. And they are good at the PR, right? They rarely apologise. When they have infighting, it doesn't end up all over the press. They are sure of what to say on TV every time and fit in with the party line, even if you know the facts are different. And it works. Possibly, you know, because it's just easier to programme in the same code on many of them. I don't know. I know people don't like Corbyn, and I'm not sure that he'd be a particularly good Prime Minister either, but I do know that he would be better than Theresa Robot May. And if you don't like him, but you also don't like Theresa May and find the idea of a Conservative government terrifying, telling everyone how shit Labour thinks just makes everyone think, oh, Labour's shit, I won't vote for them then. I don't think Labour can win. Who knows, it's this day and age, 2017 maybe, but... if unhappy Labour supporters are about to hold their noses, as they say, and if even 30% more under 25s register and vote, it might not be a total Tory NATO. It's self-destructive or simple PR. Those are our options. But, you know, what do I know? I haven't written any books about wizards, have I? Anyway, back to the full fact team. Which brings me on to the other question I wanted to ask, actually, is are there certain areas that you find are harder to fact-check than others? Are there certain things that in politics that are harder to get the exact information about?
Very much so. I mean, it varies a lot. Probably the hardest area is defence or foreign affairs. Just because, I mean, in defence, obviously, so much of the information that you might be able to get hold of is just classified. And we, 99% of our work is is publicly available information that we've gone out and dug up. So classified information is a real roadblock. We can't do a lot with that. And also foreign affairs. It's partly because we don't have as much expertise in the workings of other countries. But also, you know, if you've got, you know, statistics about the war in Syria, for instance, I mean, who actually do you go to that has reliable statistics on that kind of topic? We're very lucky in this country because we've got a very established organizations, institutions that we trust to provide information we can rely on. In other countries, they don't necessarily have that. And on the international stage, that's very difficult to find as well. So it's really difficult when you don't have that foundation of trust to go out and fact check something and give people something they can rely on.
We know these fact checkers in Argentina called Chequeado, and when they do FOI requests, they sometimes get told that they have to come into the office, come into the actual department, and pick up the papers that actually have the information that they want on it. And this one time, when they went in to pick up the papers were all blank. The guys were like, "Well, this isn't any information. There's nothing here. Where's the information we requested?" And the officials were just like, "No, no, no, it's there. It's just printed on really, really light ink."
Oh, no.
And they were just at a standstill and they couldn't do anything about it. And it was hard to push that forward. And to, what do you say in the face of someone that says there is something written here when there clearly isn't?
Yeah, that feels sort of like a Derren Brown kind of mind trick, rather than a government office. It's sort of, there is something there, believe me. Terrifying, but yeah, that must make things a lot easier in the UK, because I was wondering if it does make things a good deal easier having a number of independent organisations to work with. You know, we're quite lucky, I think, in the UK that we have some, you know, supposedly free press, and we have you know, things that aren't state owned. We have NGOs and things like that. So does that make things a lot easier?
Yeah, absolutely, because there are organisations that have been set up to basically either publish statistics separate from government or to oversee the use of statistics. For example, we have the UK Statistics Authority, and it's their job to make sure that things are being reported accurately. But when they publish something sometimes and say that it's misleading, it doesn't necessarily go as far as it should. So we've been working with them to kind of strengthen the relationships they have with the BBC and with other broadcasters, so that when they do say something, it actually holds some weight. And we kind of have these institutions, but we haven't really given them any kind of backing or support. So it's really important that we embolden them a little bit to do a bit more and to kind of grow into the role that they've been given.
Yeah, there's a previous guest we've had on this podcast, a man called Michael Marshall, who's part of the UK sort of Skeptics Society. He was discussing with us about how for example, the press has to be accurate, but it doesn't have to be truthful. If you see what I mean, it doesn't have to say that it can. If it reports, the Associated Press, if they report a statement that was said, they can say that they report it verbatim, but they don't have to say whether anything in that statement was incorrect or correct. And I guess that's the same with a lot of the authorities.
Yeah. Also, when we started, we made some corrections requests of the Daily Mail and the Sun, and doing that eventually led to them creating their corrections columns, because they didn't have them before that. Wow. So actually just making the requests and using the rules that we have in place kind of strengthens the accountability that already is there but has kind of been forgotten about a little bit. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at all times for ways that we can intervene to strengthen the ecosystem. What are the rules that need a bit more welly?
Yes, quite.
That's brilliant. That's really good. I didn't realise that was you guys that did that. That's very, very commendable. How do you make sure that you are non-partisan, that you are an independent group? Because surely there's probably always accusations that facts are pro one way or the other. How do you make sure that you're not doing that?
Well, independence is probably the most important thing to us, because that's what. Yeah, that's really what distinguishes us from a lot of other fact-checking movements that are out there. And the main things that we do safeguard that, we have obviously the cap, so that no one source of our funding comes from not too much of our funding comes from one location alone. We also have policies on conflicts of interest for our staff, for people who work with us. We have our own operating guidelines, so that we know that when we write the content that we do, we make sure that the person who's written it, you know, doesn't have a personal conflict of interest. We're also run by a cross-party board of trustees, so we make sure that, you know, it's not just the Conservatives or Labour that are giving us that kind of backing from the charity. It's we make sure that's across the board as well. And just generally, whenever you go to any full fact article and you want to read what we've done, and maybe you're suspicious of, well, how do you get, you know, how do you come to that conclusion, full fact? Why should I believe you? We always, without fail, link to our sources, so that everything that we do is something that our readers can check, and that they can replicate exactly what we've done and come to their own conclusion. So we are hugely transparent, and we have the processes in place to make that happen.
We also have restrictions on staff's political activity, so none of us are campaigning, none of us can actually tweet anything super political. So there is like a restriction on that as well from us.
That's really restrained of you. Do you just go to the pub and shout at each other after work? Is that how you... I don't know how you'd get it out of your system otherwise.
You can't tweet near each other.
It can be quite tough, actually, because you're literally on... You go to Facebook or something and you see things that you have opinions about, and you're like, no, don't touch your keyboard. Go somewhere else.
But actually, like, I feel I was very opinionated before I joined Full Fact. And actually, joining Full Fact and understanding that all the complexity and nuance that exists within these issues has kind of made me less and less, like, into shouting down one particular side. So in many ways, it is about widening your own views and being a bit more curious about the other side's views.
Yeah, same experience as you, actually, Meve, and I feel like I sit on the fence, well, everything these days, because
yeah, exactly.
I just know that, oh, no, there are statistics that suggest I'm wrong, so I shouldn't say that. It's ridiculous.
I had it with I think it might have been about education funding till 2020 or something. It was an argument, and I checked your site about it, and the actual facts are that it was somewhere in between what both sides of this argument were saying. Somebody was saying it was a lot less, and somebody was saying it was a lot more, and your site was, I think it was 8% less, but that was a lot, you know. And I was like, all right, both of you are wrong, fair enough. That's it was quite a relief.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much that happens, actually. You get this thing when you tell people about your job, they say, oh, politicians, they lie all the time, don't they? And sometimes I find, actually, politicians don't actually seem to lie. They just kind of seem to talk past each other. And most of the things that you see, it's very, very rare that a politician will say something and there's absolutely no basis for it whatsoever. Like, it's just really, really unheard of that. There's normally something that they've done to maybe they've been technically correct, but they've presented it in a slightly partial perspective or something like that. That happens all the time. But very rarely do you just get total left field, made it up completely. That's really, really rare.
That's nice. Thank heavens. That's very nice to know. Yeah, I was going to say, what a relief. Good. There's some faith left in humanity. What was, other than your site, I mean, it sort of sounds like a strange thing to get you to recommend other people, but are there, other than Full Fact, are there other efficient methods of checking, sort of like if people get their manifestos through their doors and, you know, are there good ways that people can go through them and find information easily? Are there other things that you'd recommend, other places you'd recommend that they look or read up, or what can the everyday person do if they don't have a lot of time in their hands?
No, just Full Fact.
Just Full Fact. Fair enough. I always like to ask, in case you also have any other favourites, do you have any other sort of writers or journalists or people on Twitter, if there's anyone else that you recommend that you also enjoy following for factual information?
We aren't the only fact checkers around, so there is also BBC Reality Check, and Channel 4 Fact Check as well. Channel 4 Fact Check do less political claims and more kind of verification of images and stuff. But Reality Check has just been set up and is starting to do the kind of stuff that we are, which is fantastic. So I would recommend them as well. I don't know, Joe, do you have any suggestions?
Well, for anyone, I think who actually has a specific question they want to look at more directly, I'd actually put in a shout for organisations like Wikipedia. Now, I say that knowing that some people think, oh God, Wikipedia, you can't trust that. But actually, as long as you know the difference between a primary source and a signpost. Wikipedia is basically a site for signposts. It's somewhere you can go when you've basically got almost no grounding in an issue and you just kind of want to know, what does the land look like? Where are the kind of sources coming from? Because Wikipedia, a lot on Wikipedia has citations that you can go to and then you find the actual primary sources. And actually, it's something I do sometimes when I fact check as well. When I fact check at Full Fact, I start by looking for signposts. And the internet's full of them, and you just need to know the kind of best places to look. And they really help you get by without having to necessarily go really deep into the primary sources that are normally horrible.
There is this also fantastic outfit called Simple Politics that has kind of popped up, and they do these really fantastic explainers of the way that government works and how democracy in the country works. So it's really good for that, and I would highly recommend it.
Cool. There'll be we've had Tassin from Simple Politics on the podcast a couple of times, so he will be very pleased that you recommended him. A couple more questions. One probably hopefully a more fun question, but is there anything that gets searched for on Full Fact more than anything else? And is there anything particularly weird that gets searched? Have you got any favourite things that come up more often than they should?
There's some really disturbing stuff. I think the strangest one is how long do murderers serve in prison?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
It's one of our most read articles. It's really, really bizarre because it was never... I don't even think it was that big at the time we wrote it, but people keep searching. People are fascinated by it, and so we felt the need to update it quite recently.
Oh, that's terrifying. That does very much sound like someone's going, well, if I do it, how long will I be in there for,
Yeah, exactly.
It's just scoping it out. That's terrifying. Wow. And but lastly, and very importantly, how can people sponsor Full Facts? I know you're now doing your snap election campaign, which means you're going to be working insanely hard for the next few weeks. How can people sponsor you? And also, I sponsored you, I think it was during the referendum, and I got one of the best stickers I've ever got, which is that one with a moustache on that said, that stat doesn't mean what you think it means. Yeah. Please bring those back. Please bring those back. I want to stick them everywhere.
Okay, just for you, I will bring them back.
Thanks very much.
So we are running a crowdfunding campaign to support the work that we do. Obviously, we are actually just 11 people. Everybody thinks that we're a lot bigger, but we're really not. And we do often punch above our weight. But for the election, you can imagine the number of claims skyrockets. And to do justice to that and to have a good overview of the issues that people care about and to be able to look at the things that all the parties are actually saying in enough depth, we need to grow our team really quickly. And the crowdfunding campaign that we're running at the moment is about scaling in that way. And if you could make a donation to it, we'd be really, really grateful. It's at crowdfunder.co.uk/full-fact. Joe, do you want to do your plea?
please help us. Because there's too many claims everywhere. But also, more regularly outside of elections, we have regular people who sign up for monthly or one-off donations. We have a newsletter, so if you like to keep up to tabs with the latest fact checks hot off the press, then you can sign up to those. That's all on our website, basically, fullfact.org. It's very easy to find. Meevan's responsibility is all the fundraising stuff, so she'll know exactly where you need to go.
The A monthly donation actually is slightly more than just a monthly donation at Full Fact, because it means that we can safeguard our independence. It's not just about it's great to have money to pay everyone, but it also means that having a wide base of funding actually makes us safeguard that thing that we cherish the most, because we have a rule that we don't accept more than 25% of our funding from any one place, which makes it very, very hard to grow.
Sure.
And as we've been talking about today, there's a lot more demand for fact-checking, and having a wide base of funding is a fantastic thing to boast about. So we'd be really grateful if anybody could chip in and help us with that.
Great, great. And I'm sure now they all know that they can find out how long they'll get for murder. I'm sure you'll get the questions, donations flooding in various macabre groups around the UK. Huge thanks to Meevan and Joseph at Full Fact. It was a lot of fun talking to them, and I really do use their site so often for things that I talk about in this podcast, general arguments on social media, and general usage in between shouting at the news. They are super useful, and you can find them at fullfact.org, where you can also find a link to their crowdfunding site. They're also at Full Fact on Twitter, which is worth following because they often live fact check things like Question Time or Prime Minister's Questions. And they're on Facebook at facebook.com/fullfact.org as well. I believe they're also on LinkedIn, but I have no idea if they use it, because really, whoever does? I mean, I'm still on there, but I only ever check it once a year to see if anyone else is actually there, if it's like a barren wasteland, and it's generally empty, apart from someone posting about how they were influenced to change their business after seeing a beetroot, or 10 tips on how you can lose logistics to stop crying at Pixar films. Please do sponsor Full Fact if you can, and just also use their site. Direct other people to it, and when you get your local MP's promises through the door for the election, why not check Full Fact to see if what they're saying their party has done is actually true? Or, like me, just spend time popping Full Fact links into other people's Facebook arguments, then muting the conversation and disappearing into the night like a fat ninja. A finger. A ninjacked. No, you're right. Both of those are shit. Fact. I've got a few guests lined up now for the next few weeks. Thank you for your input on the Facebook group and the Twitter as to what you want these podcasts running up to the election to include. But I'm still on the lookout for more. So, as always, if you've got a subject you'd like me to interview someone about or someone you'd like me to interview, then please, please let me know. I should also say I've had a few emails from some of you, which has been lovely, thank you, asking me to interview the likes of people like Owen Jones or Maria Mazzucato or various politicians and well-known economists, and oh God, I would love to interview all those people. However, as this podcast is pretty much all done by me, if they don't respond to my emails or my tweets or whatever else, it is quite tricky to get to ask them. They're quite busy people. So if any of you have any direct contact with anyone like that and you think you can give them a nudge to let me fire badly written questions at them for 25 minutes, please, please, please do link me up. And of course, you know you can let me know all these things by dropping me a line on the Twitter at @PartPolBro, the Partly Political Broadcast Facebook group, or partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. Or by yodeling really loud into your nearest ravine, and I'll use my specially crafted ear horn to pick up the sounds when the wind blows in the correct direction. Email is still easier. Still. After asking you for 2017 Conservative election campaign slogans 2 weeks ago and Labour campaign slogans last week, this week I inevitably asked you for potential catchphrases to sway voters for the Lib Dems. I have to say, setting these as questions has really helped me suss out who you're probably all going to be voting for. @Ed_Sun on Twitter says, "The Lib Dems, for when you're annoyed with both of the proper parties." @JohnnyDobbo has said simply, "It really could be worse." Very true. Andy Gilder says he sent to the Lib Dems when don't know isn't an option, and the Lib Dems don't vote Tory, that's our job. @ThesGo11blog says, "Lib Dems, when you don't want to support United or City, don't forget there's always Oldham." My pal @BeckHillComedian has said, "Lib Dems, let's give it another go. Please." @BenBobGray says, "Lib Dems, because Labour's going a bit working class for your liking." And he also sent, "Lib Dems, realism is only a problem for the electable." At Unreal McKay says, Lib Dems, with a leader as gormless looking as we have, our policies must be great. Genuinely, if you have a chance, watch the clip that came out today of Tim Farron falling off his own campaign bus. Oh, man. Sheer joy. Sheer joy. It's in the background of a BBC news report, and he's trying to get down off the bus and just... Oh, it's beautiful, beautiful. Nowhere near as good as the Michael Gove falling over, but it's definitely up there. At Stephen McDade says, Dem Libs, Dem Libs, Dem Dem Libs, give Dem Libs some votes. I think they should definitely use that with a horribly culturally misappropriated reggae backdrop. At Hello Dave says, Lib Dems, we definitely exist. At Thinking of Stuff says, Lib Dems, in a real poor position. At Ethan D. Lawrence says, Lib Dems 2017, you Tim Farr won't believe how cool and hip and chill we are. Easter egg pun, lovers. I'm almost certain they'd use that. At Linda Heap says, Lib Dems, more MPs than UKIP. Just. At Rick Burin says, better than gay sex. And we promise we won't raise tuition fees. Yeah, I'm sure that would work. Although, to be fair, Theresa May promised not to have a snap election as she seems to be doing fine. At Budgie says, Carlsberg don't make the least worst political parties in the 2017 general election. But if they did... At Observer 4664 says, Lib Dem, because what have you got to lose? Everything, actually. Probably everything. At Chub X says, Lib Dems, free sex. Well, all the others lie their heads off. And just wing it. Which I think all the candidates do, to be fair. At Fluff Logic says, please, we will literally beg you. Just promise you'll at least consider it. Yeah, we fired Clegg. Paul Jenkins says, Liberal Democrats in an age of extremes, stuck in the middle with you. Everyone needs a campaign song. Yeah, but I'd go for something even more middle of the road, I reckon. Andy Zoidberg Walker says, we absolutely still matter. Matt Kinson says, it's a sin not to vote for us. And come on, Tim. Nick Affia says, standing up for nothing in particular since 1988. Andrew Denny says, evade all culpability, vote Liberal Democrat. Philip Alexander says, another song one, Jesus, he knows us and he knows we're right. And Rob Skeen says, the Liberal Democrats, we promise to make the rest of the UK as nice as Westmoreland services, but only one half can have ducks. Next week, slogans for the Green Party, because yes, unlike most TV coverage, I'm putting parties in order of how many MPs they have. So if you'd like your answers to be read out, then keep your eye on the Parpol Bro Twitter and Facebook for when I post the question up next Sunday and send them in. Excellent work, all of you. And that's all for this week's Partly Political Broadcast. If you've enjoyed it, please do send me through some of your hard-earned dosh at our ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/parpolbro, or patreon.com/parpolbro sites. Review the show on iTunes or Stitcher. Subscribe and generally just tell everyone about it all the time to the point where it becomes diagnosed as a new sort of compulsive disorder, which would, after all, be great press for the podcast. Do it. Big thanks to Acast for hosting this crazy thing, and bigger shout out to my brother, The Last Skeptic, who does all the music that I use on this show, and he had his birthday on May the 8th when I recorded this. I mean, obviously, it won't be his birthday by the time you hear this, so why should I give him a bigger shout out? I mean, who does he think he is? The Queen? But look, do follow him online, and do check out his tunes that generally have people way better than Ian Duncan Smith rapping over them. I'll be back next week, by which point Theresa May will probably be refusing to speak to anyone unless it's through a hole in the door, while she shouts about everyone being out to get her and has all her urine in Dankmark bottles in a cupboard. Be all up in your ear canals like a gondola filled with politics, then. Bye. This week's show was brought to you by the number 300,000. Oh, no, wait, sorry. 80 million. Ah, oh, fuck, no. I mean, 64.3 million and then 139.1... Ah, oh, fuck it. This is hard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.